As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. This podcast episode may have ads and the occasional announcement. To listen without ads or announcements and take advantage of a host of other benefits, consider becoming a premium subscriber. Visit the website contrarian.supercast.tech. That's TECH for more information. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Aisha Tariq of MacroVisor in Dubai, rejoining the podcast. Aisha, thank you so much for coming back on.
Thank you so much for having me back on. It's awesome to be back. It's been a while.
It has. It's been more than a year, about 16 months or so. But you have some very contrarian views for us again. We can revisit some of your previous ones. But I think what's more interesting now is to talk about what you think is going to happen going forward. And to jump off with, your most contrarian take right now is that, wait for it, there's going to be a hard landing for the global economy. This comes during a time when the soft landing scenario is basically priced in, has basically become the base case, but you don't buy it.
I don't buy it at all. Let me first define our time frame a little bit, right? Just to say, just to set the stage. So our time frame is about 6 to 9 months. So we're looking out 6 to 9 months from here. And we look at the global macro picture in general. Now, when we look at the US in particular, so when let's take it a little bit, you know, developed markets versus emerging markets. So where the emerging markets are concerned, I don't think that, you know, we're going to see much of a, I think the picture there is a little bit more, let's say, confused. So we might see a hard landing, but that's, you know, a little bit, it goes with emerging markets in general when you have a hiking cycle. But I think the biggest take is for the US right now. So Europe, I think we have flat, we have about, growth is flat. Germany came in at 0% GDP. So it's not a far-fetched notion that Europe slips into a recession. So the real question here is then the US. And the US is where everybody is expecting a soft landing. So just to define what a soft landing is, it's when, you know, you narrowly avoid a recession and you don't have a high rate of unemployment, right? Now, here's the thing. We are seeing GDP increase massively, and we've seen, you know, the GDP growth rate being taken up by the various forecasters, let's say. However, when we look at the picture in totality, I don't think that the US can escape a recession. Now, the recession might not be deep, but we are seeing signs where we've had a lot of fiscal impulse come in, which has propped up the GDP. But going forward, if we need inflation to come into check the way the Fed wants it to, we will need to see a recession. We will need to see GDP come down significantly. And it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation right now, in the sense that this strong GDP is what is giving the Fed the ammunition to increase rates and keep rates higher for longer. However, on the flip side, this high level of GDP is what will keep inflation high as well. So I think that we are seeing the labor market soften a little bit, and that will eventually lead into a recession.
Okay. That's a lot for us to unpack. Very interesting. It sounds like you're saying that the Fed still needs to break stuff in the economy to solve the inflation issues, and that they haven't done that yet with existing rate hikes, if that's fair.
So the yes and no, in the sense that when we say the Fed needs to break stuff or the Fed will break stuff, we are usually looking for some kind of credit event to happen, right? So that's something big to blow up.
What about bank failures?
We saw a bit of that. You're absolutely right. We saw a bit of that in March with some of the bank failures. It didn't exactly happen the way I thought it would happen. So, or probably that anyone thought it would happen. Because when you talk about bank failures, the first thing that comes to your mind is a rising level of defaults, right? So you think that we have a whole lot of defaults and that's what's taking the bank down. That wasn't the situation in this case. So it took a lot of us by surprise. But the end result, let's say, was the same in the sense that we did see banks fail. And then this Fed obviously swooped in with their backstop, which was the bank term funding program, and they kind of helped the banks out. So I think the Fed is wary of these kind of credit events. So I don't see a huge credit event happening. And I think this is a little contrarian as well, because those of us who still believe that there will be a recession and the Fed will break stuff, they're looking for a credit event to happen for the Fed to break stuff. I think it's going to be a different kind of slowdown. I don't think it will necessarily mean something big will blow up, but I think we'll see small bits and pieces of failures, small blowups here and there, which will eventually drag, you know, growth down and take inflation down with it. So I think it's a more gradual process, which is why we see the recession coming sometime next year, perhaps. In all honesty, I don't think it will be as painful as everybody thinks.
Okay. This kind of begs the question, have we had this historically? Now, most of us are too young to remember recessions other than the COVID one, which we'll forget about for a minute. But there too, you almost always seem to have catastrophic events that precede the recession. Obviously, 08, all that stuff. Going back earlier, in the early 90s, you had the savings and loan crisis that kind of preceded that. Going back further than that, maybe geopolitical events in the late 70s, early 80s, whatever. But do you think it's feasible and possible for us to have a recession without a major catalyst like that?
So I do think, yes, it is feasible. And that's why I think the recession will be milder than what, you know, would happen under a normal credit event. So it won't be like a 2008 kind of scenario where we did have a major credit event or a series of major credit events that took the markets down, that took the economy down and put the economy into a long recession, right? So whether we like to admit it or not, I think we still call it the great financial crisis for a reason, right? And we saw the effects of that, sort of the repercussions of that all over the globe. I do think this time it won't be so globalized. I think everyone will have their own localized problems, let's say. There is more global connectivity for sure, but I do think every part of, you know, every region that will probably go through this correction has their own issues, let's say.
And this begs the question now, and this gets into another contrarian call that you have about the Fed. And if we look now at futures markets, they're pricing in just a 20% chance, 2-0, of the Fed hiking rates at their next meeting, which is September 26th. But you don't quite buy that either.
Right. So I think there are two calls right now for the September meeting. One says that there'll be no Fed hikes at all. Like, this is it. We're done. And then the other is that we will skip September and have a hike in November. Now, we have the summary of economic projections as well coming out in September with the Fed meeting. So that's something to remember. And when we see those numbers, more often than not, the Fed adjusts during those, when those numbers are released. So my idea is we do see a hike in September. I know I might be totally wrong here, but I think they hike in September and then they're done.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I see it play out.
Yeah. And so I just checked and it's actually 21% now, 21.5%, according to Fed Fund Futures, that are expecting a rate hike in September. If you go out to November, we're looking at 50%, 5-0. What makes you think the Fed will hike now rather than in November?
So I think we have a few more data points coming out. We have the labor market data for that's on 1st of September, this Friday. And then we have PCE this week. And we have one more CPI coming up before the Fed meeting. And I think these will come in hotter than expected, in the sense that, you know, the labor market wouldn't move as much as expected, which gives the Fed, you know, ammunition to hike. And then on the other hand, you have, you know, the PCE and the inflation, the CPI inflation data, which is likely to come out slightly hotter than expected as well. Last month, we didn't see much of a movement in the housing data, which is, as you know, the largest part of inflation. And I think seeing a downside movement in that number is what will probably change the Fed's mind. So they were saying that we should start seeing this number drop in July. And that was our take as well. So I did some calculations and I also thought it would be June, July when we see this number start to drop. But we aren't seeing that drop. And we know that housing has come back to a large extent. So it remains to be seen whether that really makes a big move. It may make a move, but I don't think the move will be big enough to deter the Fed from, you know, hiking.
Right, right. Amanda, so then you think they're done. Now, do we see cuts next year?
I do think we'll see cuts next year, but the market is pricing in pretty drastic cuts. Again, I think that may go back to the idea that we'll see a recession and we might have a credit event and so on and so forth. Plus, we have an election year. So this is another reason why I think the Fed will not go beyond this year when it comes to hiking. So they'll try to finish as quickly as possible. For the next year, I do think we'll see cuts, but I don't think it will be as aggressive as people are pricing in. I think it will be very shallow cuts, 25 basis points to start with. And I think they'll be far more gradual than people think.
Mm, yeah. And there too, as I look here at Fed Fund Futures, 20% are pricing in a rate cut of 50 basis points by June. So obviously the more forward-looking you get, the more out there some of these expectations are, but still, that's pretty interesting.
I don't think they even start before June. So
really?
I'm thinking the first rate cut would be somewhere maybe June or July, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Sick of me yet? Become a premium subscriber and avoid all ads or interruptions. Other benefits as well. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving.
How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Now, usually when the U.S. sneezes, the world catches a cold. But you're saying now maybe the rest of the globe will hold on a little better.
So it depends. So I think there are certain emerging market economies that may not slip into a recession per se. For example, Mexico, Brazil, they're doing quite well. They were very early in their hiking cycle. They were very aggressive. So all things considered, they aren't faring too poorly. They're actually doing quite well compared to the U.S. Where China is concerned, I think China, they're obviously they're far away from a recession, but I do think that their growth declines quite a bit. Now, for them, anything below 5% is actually, let's say, recessionary, you know, because they've had above normal growth for the last 40 years. Their growth has averaged, GDP growth has averaged at around 8%. Above 8%. So that's like a big drop for them. I think Japan will do okay. So really, it's the UK, Europe, and the US that I think is going to be in a dilemma. Perhaps Australia as well to some extent, but not as much as these three regions.
Mm. But these are the biggest consumers globally, yes. The US, Europe, and the UK. And you think that the rest of the world can be all right with those slowing, the consumers retrenching?
So I don't think we'll have massive growth, but I think they can. I think growth might be stable at a very low level. Mm-hmm. Plus, don't forget, a lot of things have changed in terms of energy and agriculture and those kind of, you know, so the commodity space has changed quite a bit, right? And as long as we have oil above a certain level, there are countries in the world who actually prosper from that, right? So the Middle East, for example, where I am, the OPEC countries will do okay. So it's a bit of a, you know, odd situation right now. And I think it will be a balancing act, let's say.
Mm-hmm. And you don't seem particularly worried about China either.
So where China is concerned, I think we will be chopping around in a range for a while. I don't see huge upside this year. The issue is the Chinese government has a target of 5% GDP. So as long as they don't see that 5% target threatened to a large extent, they are not going to do anything either way, so negative or positive. So they won't have any large scale, let's say, stimulus or negative, you know, issues. But so I do think that they will start, the market will just chop in a range. However, they do have their own problems and they have to eventually take care of this. So my idea is we probably see more of that coming in towards the first quarter of next year versus anything actually happening this year. I think they hold on to their tiny measures for now. And for the market to actually take off there, what we do need is a very, you know, what they're calling a bazooka-like stimulus measure, right? So we need something drastic for the government to do something drastic to, you know, get the market moving there.
Mm-hmm. And if they have deflation, you figure they'd be able to do that, right?
So you would think so, but they have localized problems in other areas. So their property market, as you know, is like in shambles right now. They have their local governments, you know, financing vehicles, LGFV, that has a lot of debt. There's a lot of debt coming due that needs to be refinanced. You know, rates are still relatively high. So we are seeing, and the cash flow isn't coming in as, you know, we would expect. Consumption has not taken off the way one would hope. So people are saving more than they are consuming. It feels like the Chinese people have lost a bit of faith in the government, in their economy, and they're just saving up their money right now because they're, let's say, a little cautious of what might happen in the next 6 to 9 months.
Now, leading into that, the commodities, you also have some contrarian views there. Yeah, tell us about that.
Right. So my contrarian view is on copper. Mm-hmm. We know that copper is called Dr. Copper, and it's called Dr. Copper because it sort of signals what happens in the economy. So when copper is going down, we know that the economy is contracting, we're seeing recessions and so on and so forth. So with my call of a potential recession in the US and the UK and the slowdown in China, I still think copper might go higher from here. And the reason is, so immediately with the immediate, in the next 2 to 3 months, we might see muted prices, but in 6 to 9 months, I see copper higher from where we are right now. And despite a slowdown, despite, a recession, and that's because the demand for copper is changing, right? And copper stockpiles are still pretty low. So if you look at the data, you see that sentiment is low, which is driving price down. But the actual stockpiles haven't increased the way we needed to. So my feeling is that supply is going to take over, and the low supply will actually drive prices up versus the demand side coming in.
Hmm. Okay. And on the demand side, is China no longer the biggest consumer of importer of copper? Or are there others?
Oh, they are. They are. But they haven't stopped. So their biggest market was the property market and the infrastructure market, where copper was used for copper wiring and all of that. But as I said, the demand has shifted a little bit, right? So now they are doing mass scale EV production, which needs a lot of copper. And you see that everywhere. So even though some, sectors don't have the demand for copper, there are other sectors that do have the demand for copper, and those sectors are growing. Maybe not at the same pace, but they are growing. And so there is a certain level of pressure on that supply.
Interesting. All right. This is all very interesting stuff. Aisha Tariq, I want to take a quick break and come back and ask you some more questions from our listeners, if you'll indulge us. But let's first take a quick break and give our sponsors a minute to be heard. If you are a premium subscriber, you will not get the break. So don't touch the dial. Stay right here. We'll be right back. In fact, we already are. And everybody else, to become a premium subscriber, visit the website contrarianpod.substack.com and sign up.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of the Contrarian Investor Podcast, where we give voice to those who challenge a prevailing narrative in global financial markets. Consider becoming a premium subscriber. For $9 a month or less, premium subscribers receive a number of benefits. Podcasts are posted immediately after they're recorded. Transcripts are made available within 24 hours. Premium subscribers get direct access to the host, and of course, there are no ads or interruptions. Visit contrarian.supercast.tech for more information.
By the way, you don't need the .tech suffix to get to that website. .com will do the trick. And we also have a Substack that you can, where you can sign up for the same prices, same benefits, same details. contrarianpod.substack.com. So if you already have a Substack account and use it, or have the app and use that, that's probably the best way to go. So contrarian.supercast.com or contrarianpod.substack.com, whole bunch of benefits, including, of course, getting this episode up to a week early without ads or annoying announcements. And you also get the Daily Contrarian briefing and podcast that is released every market day morning at 7 a.m. This is a contrarian take on the events of the day ahead and what is likely to move markets, such as economic data releases, earnings, and other things. It is really good, and that is completely unbiased, of course. So check that out, contrarianpod.substack.com or contrarian.supercast.tech. Now on with the show. Welcome back, everybody, here with Aisha Tariq joining us from sunny Dubai. At least I'm assuming it's sunny. Macrovisor.com. This is usually the segment of the podcast where we ask our guest some background about themselves. However, you've been on before, and so we have your background already. People can and should go back and listen to that. And we also have a new feature, which are listener questions. Before I get to those, though, I want to ask you one more question about interest rates and central bank policy. And you still have inflation, as you mentioned, running a little hotter than the Fed would like. But you don't see any more rate cuts, rate hikes beyond the one, either September or November. That's it. And for next year either. But are there other things that these central banks might do to combat inflation?
Yes, that's a great question. Thank you for that. So you're right. I do think that inflation is still running very high. In fact, it's still double the target that, you know, they need to get to, right? Both in Europe and in the US. And historically, we've seen from 4% to 2%, that's where it gets very, very tricky. Now, as I said, I don't think the US will hike after this year because it's an election year next year. But they do need to step up the pace of QT. So what they've been doing as of now and rolling off the bonds, it's working. But if you look at the balance sheet in general, I mean, it hasn't come down as much as one would hope, right? So we're still far, far above the level we were pre-pandemic. And I think that's what needs to change for inflation to come down. So, and when we talk about Europe, I think Europe will probably be one and done as well. But I think that would be a mistake. I honestly think that they should do two more rate hikes because don't forget, they started much later than the US and inflation is still higher there, whereas their policy rate is still much lower than the US. So they still have room to hike. I think they're okay on their balance sheet runoff policies, but I think where they need to step up the game is hiking rates.
Interesting. Okay. And so, but here too, you think that the Fed can do this without causing a major recession?
I do think so. I still think that the Fed could, I mean, it will be a hard landing at the end of the day, but let's say it will be a smoother hard landing.
Okay, cool. All right. Let's move on now to the listener question segment of the podcast. Like I said, a brand new segment. I'm excited that you are the first person that we have these with because you have a very good following on the social media. And so that was helpful to generate questions. If your question is read on the air, you win one of these mugs and we'll pay for shipping regardless of where you are. And on that, this week, we got some good questions, a bunch of them. But the one that I would like to address, actually a couple here, this is from Twitter user Gonzalo DLGR. Gonzalo asks here a couple questions. Here's one that's in the news. And I'm actually curious also about your views on this. NVIDIA, and this AI hype train, as I call it. What do you make of that?
Well, they smashed their earnings, all right.
Yeah.
So look, I think NVIDIA as a company is great. I'm not going to bash the company, honestly. I think they've been doing great job. Well, the truth is they've been doing a great job. Look at the numbers they've put up,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So you can't deny that. You can say whatever you want about the AI story or however they made it and how they got to their, you know, 70% gross margins. You can criticize all of that. But at the end of the day, it's capitalism. If they can get away with 70% margins, why wouldn't they? And they're posting revenues as they said they would. So they're growing at a massive clip. So good on them. Great on them, in fact, right? But the hype that they've created, I don't think this translates well to everyone, right? So one thing to remember, and I did put out this as a tweet as well, that NVIDIA's gain is everybody else's cost. So they are making, you know, let's say the raw materials for this entire AI space, right? But at the same time, that means it's a cost for the other people. So right now, I think there are two things that we need to understand about AI. First of all, in order for this to be a sustainable, let's say, you know, journey, we need to see these companies actually invest. And that means costs, capex, you know, money spent, number one. Number two, we don't know whether AI is proven or not. So we're still far, far away from actual intelligence. So we have, I've said this before as well, we have the artificial, we don't have the intelligence yet, right? And so I think, you know, the proof will be in the pudding, as they say. And we don't have that as yet. So the sad part is what we have done is we have pulled forward all these earnings for these companies to this year. We've bid these companies up to enormous levels. And now we have a situation where we have these handful of companies that are extremely expensive based on something that hasn't been fully proven yet. But we are paying the price for this already. So in my mind, I think there's still some ways to go in this. And we definitely need to see how this plays out over the next 2 to 3 years. I'm not at all saying that these companies are bad companies. I mean, at least the big ones, so Google and NVIDIA and all of these. But at the same time, we need to bear in mind that they haven't proven their worth in terms of AI as yet, but we're already paying for it.
The fact that these companies are attracting all these investments, do you think that's another indicator that the Fed hasn't done enough yet in terms of raising rates?
Look, where these companies are concerned, the Magnificent Seven, I think it's very, let's say, it actually goes hand in hand with the Fed's tightening cycle, because these companies are your safety net companies, right? And it's like, you know, buying Apple is like buying a bond right now, like a government bond, you know, they're not going to fail. So in that respect, I think these companies going up actually show how scared people are about the Fed's tightening cycle. And then they're kind of hiding out in these solid names. And that's why these companies have been bid up. That's part of the reason why these companies have been bid up so much as well.
Very interesting. Yeah. Okay. We'll have to see what happens with NVIDIA. And next question, also from Gonzalo. He asks here about banks. And I ask you this because I know you've written about this, how to analyze bank stocks around their earnings. We're right in between earnings seasons right now. I guess the still a couple trickling in from the, what was it, the second quarter? Yeah, second quarter. And now then we'll have a bit of a waiting period before we get the third quarter earnings, but the banks will be the ones to kick it off, as they always do. And he asks, how do you go about analyzing banks ahead of earnings? And you, maybe this is depends on the state of the economic cycle as well. But yeah, what kind of stuff would you look to at the bank earnings?
So absolutely, you're right. Some of it does depend on the economic cycle. But I do have a cheat sheet that I put out on Twitter every quarter before earnings, because banks, honestly, are very different from companies. Obviously, the assets are liabilities, the liabilities are assets. So it's just like opposite, right? So it's not always easy to look at them. But a few things that I would look at, obviously, is your net interest margin. And this is the top line in terms of how much a bank is earning versus their interest costs, right? So that's very important. Looking at the expense ratio is very important. And then looking at their capital adequacy is very important. So how much capital these banks actually have, because they need to withstand pressures in the economy. And the other thing I would look at now particularly is how much provisions they're putting away. Right. And so that's provisions for losses. So we need to see whether actual losses are increasing, but also how much the provisions are increasing. So over the last 1 year, you will see JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs, particularly those who have more consumer banks. So JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, you see their provisions increase far more because what they're doing is they're putting aside funds or, let's say funds in simple terms to withstand those losses that may come, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the more scared they are, the higher their provisioning is. So that's something to, you know, look at in this environment in particular.
Do you get a lot from the interviews with the CEOs? I tend to find that Jamie Dimon of JP has a lot of pretty interesting things to say usually, and also less hedged than some of the others, although he does hedge a bit. But yeah, do you watch, is anybody you watch in particular?
Jamie Dimon.
The
interesting thing about listening to him as well is there'll always be some analyst coming in and asking him some kind of spicy question. And then, you know, that sets him off and you really, really get his real side and his real thoughts. So that's quite interesting. But to be fair, JP Morgan is a bank that's everywhere and it has everything, right? So it has corporate banking, investment banking, and consumer banking. So they're a bank that you would want to listen to because they cover every sphere of, you know, banks or banking activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I believe the largest U.S. lender in absolute terms, perhaps, I'm not entirely sure about that, consumer lender.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay. This is all very interesting. Aisha, in closing, maybe tell us how our listeners can find out more about you. I mentioned you're active on the social media, macrovisor.com. You can tell us about that too and what you guys offer there, because I'm interested in that.
Sure. So we started Macrovisor about 6 to 7 months ago now. So it's a pretty new company. But what we do over there is we look at the global macro picture. And obviously, you know, we're building it as we go. So we've just started a dashboard on the global macro scene. So we put out, you know, short-term views, long-term views, what to look out for. I put out a free daily breakfast bites, which kind of gives us the news and views from around the world. It gives you the calendars. So everything, anything and everything that you need to know about, you know, macro around the world, it's in there. Plus, we have our longer form thematic research that we do on either certain countries, regions, specific factors, like we did the labor market, we did the housing market. We did China. And then we also put picks. So asset picks, so could be stocks, could be commodities, what we're looking at, buy, sell, hold, that kind of thing.
Mm. All right. Can I ask if there's anything you're particularly bullish about right now?
Am I particularly bullish about anything? Yes, I am. So there are certain healthcare names that I'm pretty bullish about still. MedTech is a good area. I know I've been talking about it for a while now, but I still think that there is some runway there for growth.
Very interesting. Okay, that's great. So you can give us a name there. Okay, and then the social media, I'll put this all in the show notes too.
Sure. So social media, I'm on Twitter, of course. The handle is Aisha Zarik, one word, and I'm on LinkedIn as well.
Cool. Yeah. And have you found any uptake in the other social media? Do you use any of those? Because I know that Twitter has undergone all these changes.
I've been using LinkedIn for a while, but mm-hmm. I think LinkedIn, I'm seeing ebbs and flows because, you know, people are going back to work. So things have thinned out a little bit over there. I think more people who are more professional, use LinkedIn. Not to say that professionals don't use Twitter as well,
sure.
But I think Twitter is just easier to use. I've tried a few. I've tried Instagram. I've tried Threads. I've tried Reddit. Twitter is just the easiest. And for me, you know, time is kind of money.
Yeah,
so I'd rather spend more time researching and producing than worry about these things.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. And I have tried out all these other ones. And it seems the Twitter experience is just not that hard to replicate. They've all tried to, and it's all come up a little short in my view, which
true.
You know, maybe says something about what Elon is sitting on there, but that's another topic for another day. So yes, with that, we will close. Thank you all for listening. We look forward to having you back again, Aisha, in the near future, sooner than we did last time. And everyone else will speak to you again next week. Talk then. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
It's the Kia Summer Sticker Sales Event, so give your friends something to look at, like a B&B with an ocean view, an endless field of wildflowers, or a sunset that needs no filter. Make this a summer to share and save with a capable Kia SUV or powerful sedan. See your local Kia dealer or visit Kia.com to learn more. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-334-KIA for details. Always drive safely. Sale applies to purchase of specially tagged 2024 vehicles only. Quantities are limited. Must take delivery by 7/8/24.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.